This is the Experience Points Podcast, episode 187 for September 5th, 2012. Welcome
back, everybody. This is the Experience Points Podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
I am George Abor.
We're the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It's a website we created and dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. And today, George and I are excited to have a longtime friend, Michael Abbott, back on the podcast. Hey, Michael.
Hey, guys.
Michael is the author of BrainyGamer.com, professor of theater at Wabash College. All-around awesome guy, one of our earlier guides into the world of video game writing on the internet.
We should also say congratulations, Michael. You recently celebrated 5 years of the Brainy Gamer?
Yes, that was just a few days ago. Yeah.
That's quite an accomplishment.
Yeah, 5 years is a long time in this business, isn't it?
Yeah, on the internet, 5 years might as well be, well, the internet, you know?
Yeah. I feel very grateful to have, you know, still have people interested in reading it, and I've slowed down a little bit just because of, you know, I'm busy with many things, but I still write it regularly, and you know, I'm really happy when people come by and read it.
And a lot of people do come by and read it because, as you say, you know, you're still active on it, you're putting out you know, you haven't rolled into the mode of best of Brainy Gamer every single week. You know, you're still churning away with that original content that we're so hungry for, which is, you know, one of the reasons we had you on the show this week. You know, a couple weeks ago, Michael wrote a post on his site called Why We JRPG, explaining what compels him and, you know, many other people to continue playing the Japanese RPG genre after all these years, and after some critical thinking about the genre and what it means for today's game industry and what it has meant in the past and what it means going forward as well. And, you know, George and I were talking before the show, Michael, that we were having somewhat of a hard time remembering the last JRPG game we played. George, did you ever come up with something? I think I came up with, I played the demo of Final Fantasy XIII 2, like within the past couple months.
Final Fantasy XIII is probably the last one I actually played, and I didn't finish that one, so...
But finishing means, like, I mean, I remember we played a little bit of that together.
Yeah, I mean, Chrono Trigger, probably.
Right. But Michael, you've been playing JRPGs recently, right?
Yeah, I have. In fact, just tonight, before we started talking, I was playing The Last Story. Yeah, I play them all the time. I mean, I typically play the, if it's, you know, a mainstream kind of AAA JRPG, and they, you know, obviously they don't come out as often as they used to, but they still arrive with a fair amount of frequency. I try to play them, yeah.
And so, and this, the post that you wrote was largely focused on the pretty recent game Xenoblade Chronicles, right?
Right, which I think is just terrific. You know, I think it's just an amazing JRPG. And not amazing like, oh, you know, 10 years ago, this would have been a really great game, and look, it's still a great game. I think it's a great take on the JRPG genre, and it still contains all the, or most of, you know, the kind of core design elements. But
is Xenoblade Chronicles self-aware?
No, it really isn't. I mean, to a certain degree. Well, I mean, I think what interests me in it and what interests me in the genre in general is that, I mean, on a certain level, you could say that one way of describing the history or the evolution of game design has been that we've gotten more and more clever at hiding the systems underneath games.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that, so now, it used to be you would hide systems by sort of distracting the player to think about other things, or that you would make them clever little, you know, they're almost like mini games around systems that would keep you entertained. But now, you know, we're so immersed in cinematic stuff, and narrative games can do so many things to make you forget that there's this, you know, this whirring parts underneath it all. Mm-hmm. That, You know, I think JRPGs have never forgotten that they're really sitting on top of spreadsheets, really. You know, that they're, that there's something that certain players like me like about this system kind of spinning away underneath me, and that I'm aware that it's there, and the game doesn't really go too far out of its way to hide that stuff.
And that was the main thrust of the article. You know, you were talking about it using a car analogy. You know, like it allows you to get under the hood, and, you know, it doesn't try to hide it. It doesn't try to obscure the engine that's driving everything, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it certainly it's not as naked as some early RPGs, or, you know, early Western RPGs too. You know, play any of those old RPGs from the Ultima era. You know, you're very aware that, you know, what's happening game design wise, but you know, I think there are people like me who will play JRPGs because we just like them and we'll continue to play them, and sometimes they disappoint us, and, you know, but we kind of go along. And I think the thing about Xenoblade is that it's sleek. It has active battle that works beautifully. But it's also, you know, I think JRPGs tend to be very ambitious narrative-wise. I think they really don't get a fair shake typically with that. I think we sort of, I don't know, shake our heads at, you know, more anime characters and more androgynous.
So many belt buckles.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like it.
But, I mean, I think that there's something going on with this game and some other games that suggest that the creators have a fair amount of ambition when it comes to telling the story, and that they're, you know, in this case, you know, the environments in the game are embedded into what the game means.
Mm-hmm.
That the meaning of the game reveals itself in some ways through the environments. And we love talking about games like BioShock, and, you know, what a great thing that BioShock does this. And I've written about it. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? This game does it too, and nobody wants to talk about it.
You know, I bought Xenoblade Chronicles for my brother, who really, really likes JRPGs. I bought it for him on his birthday, which is in early June. And then the other day I asked him, like, you know, how'd that turn out? I heard it was kind of an interesting game. He's like, well, I'm about 50 hours in, and I'm thinking I'm about 3/4, you know? And so
Oh my God.
I was just like talking to him about this. And is it too much of a spoiler to say, like, I think I know what you're talking about for the environments. Like, will that really kind of take away from people's experience if I talk about it a little bit?
No, I don't think so. No,
okay.
I'm not. I think we need to move past this spoiler fear stuff anyway. You know?
that was one of the things that we were going to talk about in the podcast too, because you explicitly talk about it in your post. So I asked my brother, I was like, you know, so what's the deal with it? And he's like, well, the environments are huge, and they're also, you're basically inside of creatures. Like, the environments are living animals, basically.
Really?
Yeah, and I was like, what? What is going on here? Like, that's just not anything that I expected him, from a JRPG, basically.
Yeah, there is a biosphere and there is a sort of mech sphere. These two warriors collide long ago, and they sort of are locked in this perpetual battle, sort of frozen in this kind of clash of swords, and each of those worlds represents the two kind of yin yang of the universe,
right.
And so everything that happens in, it's like the whole world is stationed on these two characters, and so you're literally navigating them by like walking over their shins and their elbows,
right.
And their, yeah. And so, and part of the meaning of the game, and here's, I won't go too far with this, but part of what the game's about is exploring this dichotomy. And, you know, everyone thinks they have the idea, have the right answer about what's good and what's bad and, you know, how all this should play out. And
mm-hmm.
humans are obviously superior to mechs because, you know, we are human. And, you know, the game really problematizes all kinds of stuff like that. And if you're interested in playing it out, you'll find that the game continues to reveal interesting new things to you way deep in the game. I mean, 40, 50 hours in the game. But I'll just say, you don't have to play it forever. It doesn't have to be a 60 or an 80 hour. I mean, if you just want to really plow through the main mission and not get too distracted, it can be a shorter game.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, from a systems perspective, to some extent, I feel like we associate JRPGs with grandeur, right? Huge epic storylines, and to some extent as well, really deep mechanical systems, in the sense that there's a lot of customization or various other ways in which we can hone in on the little itty-bitty pieces of the game and build something greater from that. If you do decide to go along a more singular path and just focus on the story, how does that affect the way that you see the system, right? Because it seems like you're describing an appreciation for the interplay between all aspects of the game that you see. You know, right. Are you selling yourself short if you just focus on the main storyline and ignore the side parts?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about this game is there are side parts, but they don't. Everything sort of feels connected in this game. It doesn't have that mm-hmm. that feeling of, you know, I'm just going to go fool around and waste my time doing these other things for a while, and then I'll get back to these other quests. And these quests are marked in blue because they're main quests, and these are marked in green. The game doesn't really work like that.
The Skyrim dilemma.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm playing Sleeping Dogs, and it's the same thing there, you know. But you track your progress typically in RPGs with how your character moves along in the world, and typically that's a leveling system, right? So you know, you'd see the world, you do X, Y, and Z, and you level up. And that's part of Xenoblade, but really what marks your progress in Xenoblade is our relationships. Mm-hmm. And so what the game does, I think in a remarkable way, is it creates relationships as a system. Mm-hmm. So you can visually graph out your relationships that you've established in the game with other people, and some of them are just sort of NPC type characters, but others are way more important. And as you go along in the game, you mark your progress, and that those things help you in various ways in the game, strengthen you. It sort of in ways like they do in the real world, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the relationships are quantifiable in a
yes,
way.
Yeah, exactly, and. They literally, you can pull back on a map and look at the kind of the matrix of your relationships with people in the world. And it becomes quite an amazing thing after you spend a lot of time in the game to sort of look at all the people you've met. And, you know, the game does these clever little things as you're moving along. You'll come across this little area, and if you walk into it, you can sort of get this little flashback moment of a meaningful thing that happened to your character with another character, a conversation, a discovery, a romantic moment or whatever that happened in that spot in the world at some point earlier in your life. And you'll walk upon it, and sometimes they aren't alive because you haven't sort of activated them yet. You haven't sort of solidified that relationship with the person, but other times it is functional. And, you know, it doesn't really advance the game in any certain kind of way. It doesn't, you know, you don't get points for it or anything. But just in terms of storytelling, it adds a whole kind of dimension to, a richness to the storytelling that I really liked.
Yeah. When I think of not just RPGs, but really any sort of complex system in a game, even something like, I don't know, Civilization or Fate of the World, I tend to think of interacting with those systems as a way of achieving mastery over them. But the way you're describing Xenoblade Chronicles, it's almost as though you're just navigating through a sort of pre-existing system, or that system is built by you naturally just going through the everyday actions that one might go through as your hero or protagonist.
Yeah, exactly. And, an example would be if you have a relationship between two characters on, I guess, pure kind of gameplay level, you can equip each other's abilities or skills. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of a cool thing. It incentivizes having relationships. You know, the game takes that several other levels. So, you know, there's sort of like a talent tree involved. It sort of morphs into that. Mm. So your character is who he or she is, but you wind up modding that character pretty extensively through all of these relationships.
So is there a zero-sum aspect to that? Can you have strong relationships with everybody, or are you limited in terms of your leveling up space?
No, you can have relationships with everybody. I mean, in some ways it's just helpful in trading. If it's just an NPC character and you've struck up a relationship with them, you'll get a better deal on things or whatever. But with other characters, it genuinely does help you, and it makes you... I don't think you could achieve what you can achieve in the game through relationships if you didn't have them. I think that there's no alternate path for making your character. I mean, for example, it's, you know, relationships are connected to how you explore what opens up, crafting, quests that open up. So if you don't mess around with relationships, certain things just will remain closed to you.
Right.
George, when you were talking about mastery, I was thinking about, you know, why I like JRPGs. You know, in one aspect, it's because they kind of simplify and systematize something that can never be cut and dry in our day-to-day lives. Mm-hmm. So, like, I was thinking a lot about Persona and Persona 4 and, like, the social link system. It's like, oh, man, I'm on social link 8 with Chie or something. But, you know, in real life, you know, I'll never know if I am social link 7 or 8 with Michael. You know, like, it's just something yeah. that is, like, not systematized that overtly. And so I think for someone, I don't want to call it, like, really escapism in a way, but there is something alluring, I think, to people to, you know, like to see a model, like, get under the hood of a system that that is usually pretty obscure.
Yeah.
But I don't want to make that seem like it necessarily like takes away from like the complexity of it or maybe even like the reality of it. I mean, because it is abstracted, you know, like it is an abstract social system.
Yeah, I mean, I think translating human or social systems into games, I think, is really interesting, and there's a lot of space there still left to be mined.
Yeah.
But my concern usually falls towards making it something that is so quantifiable that it loses the sort of chaos or unpredictability of actual human relations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I mean, I wouldn't want to call playing Persona 4 a form of escapism in the sense that now, you know, when I play relationship simulators, they're so much easier than real life girlfriends.
Right,
or,
you know. Exactly.
But you know, there's an aspect of maybe not even exploring or selling those relationships short if it becomes something that is something to be mastered as opposed to be something to be explored or something to be, you know, tangential to the general I need to win mentality in games.
I feel like that's where series like Mass Effect come in, you know, by trying to do something a little bit more, you know, a little bit more literal, you know, that there are hidden things that you'll never really know about. You don't even the way like you select dialogue in Mass Effect, like, you know, you choose what you want Shepard to say and then Shepard says it. And then you think to yourself, oh, I didn't think that was going to come out as angry as it did, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We could go farther, right? I mean, I don't think that the Mass Effect 3 is as close to a JRPG as, say, you know, the first Fallout. Mm. Right. And I think that, you know, if we wanted to get really specific, what if we said every time you changed the weapon of a ally in Mass Effect, they became slightly more antagonistic towards Commander Shepard
right.
because they have a certain relationship with their weapon, or, you know, there's a lot of ways we can make the relationship systems in Mass Effect even more complex than they already are.
Mm.
Right. And at some point, like, there's this payoff of you have to decide, you know, is one going to make the game more difficult than too complex, or is it that we actually need that complexity to genuinely get across how crazily complex human relationships are?
Right, right. But, you know, at that point, you might lose the ability to, you know, like Michael was describing with Xenoblade, to tie it into, to use it as a metaphor. You know, it's not really supposed to be a literal, it's like a, you know, it is a metaphor for what's happening on the game itself. I mean, the Xenoblade thing continues to fascinate me because I feel like in a lot of JRPGs that I've played, the settings themselves are somewhat incidental to whatever is going on, you know, mechanically.
Right. It's like, yeah, and Takahashi is, you know, he's a pretty ambitious fellow, you know. I mean, anybody who titles his games after Nietzsche folks, you know, I mean, there's something probably worth paying attention to there.
Right.
One, you know, the thing about relationships, and maybe this just has more to do with characters, but He just keeps bringing them on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
You think you've met everybody that's going to matter because you know how RPGs work, and you know by the first number of hours or so, you've got these four characters or whatever, or you can park a character somewhere and pick them up later and go do something. But here they keep bringing characters that matter into the story, and ultimately your avatar in the game in a way takes on a persona sort of like you actually are, which is you're playing the game, but you're experiencing all the things that are happening around you. So you sort of care about this kid, but the kid really kind of fades into the background.
Mm-hmm.
It's you start seeing the world through his eyes, and I think games try to do that a lot, but there's always so much. You got to do this or that with the character. He's got to experience this, you know, particular plot change or this turning point or whatever. And I think in this game, it's not really about the main character. He's your conduit, but really it's you navigate through this world experiencing a lot of interesting turning sort of points in the story that make you think, oh, I want to see where this goes. And then that goes somewhere and then something else opens up and you want to see where that goes.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a perfect game, and it probably some people will find it tedious because it does have certain JRPG tropes, but it's just been a long, long time since I've played a game that kept me interested for so long. And
right.
You guys are the same way. I play tons of games. I mean, I'm always playing games. And to stick with this one, to stick with one for so long, it's just not something I do very much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm trying to think. I think it was Tom Chick who wrote a bunch of posts about this game. I mean, I think he became an evangelist for the game, basically,
right,
in ways that are pretty unusual for him these days. I think he wrote very passionately about it. And I think one of the points I remember him making was that the game, it's sort of like an MMO.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not. So you have this feeling of it, of this world changing and having sort of MMO-like characteristics, but you sometimes have to remember it's not an MMO. And I thought, I didn't quite get what he meant by that when I read it, because I read his piece before I started even playing the game at all, and I remember coming back to that thinking, okay, I get what he means, that there's a certain way the game feels alive in ways that MMOs feel alive with other people in it, and I think games in particular, you know, single-player games are pretty awful at that, really, most of the time.
Yeah.
And this one really does have this weird way of feeling like an MMO.
So, like, going back to some of the tropes and the things that we now associate with, like, the genre being stale, like, what are those things, do you think? Like, I have my ideas about, like, why people have kind of become more critical about JRPGs in the past few years or so, but what do you think, like, if you were to objectively look at it, like, what is the thing that scares people away from JRPGs?
I think when JRPGs started, they were mostly about how to build narratives on top of systems.
Mm.
And now, over time, when JRPGs sort of, in a way, fell too much in love with themselves, they became about narratives with systems attached to them.
Right.
These kind of crazy, overarching, you know, labyrinthine kind of epics that they became just sort of dripping with, like, stuff that just doesn't need to be there.
Mm.
And you know, ponderous, you know, ruminating about anything, religion.
Crystals, so many crystals.
Yeah, exactly.
Gaia.
People just started to, I think, they become cliches, and ultimately, that stuff, it's a bit, I think, like Metal Gear lost its way. People get mad at me, but that it becomes so in love with its own kind of storytelling that the thing that sort of made the thing tick to begin with gets kind of pushed to the side.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I was
so, yeah.
I'll jump on the, like, unpopular opinion bandwagon. I was thinking a lot about the Final Fantasy games leading up to the podcast. I was listening to someone else, I think it was Jeff Gerstmann, kind of espouse a similar opinion, where perhaps Final Fantasy VII was actually a really bad thing to happen to the JRPGs.
yes.
Because, you know, that was a game that was essentially sold and accepted and embraced on, you know, a huge sweeping story, you know, obviously one of the earlier, you know, cutscene driven console experiences, super story driven. And then I started thinking about what you actually do in Final Fantasy VII, and I realized that, And also, this was the case in Final Fantasy VI, but, like, any character could essentially have any ability. Like, you equipped items and magic, and you could essentially learn anything. And so going through the story, it really didn't matter who you were controlling. It only mattered who the game put on front of the stage when the dialogue and cutscene portions were happening. So you kind of had to, like, go through this weird double experience, somewhat like Metal Gear, where it's like a part of it is about sneaking around and shooting, part of it is about getting out your flowchart and trying to cover the story. And, like, with the Final Fantasy series, I feel like there was a huge turning point where there was, like, it really doesn't matter structurally who you pick to go into battle, because the story will always be a certain way no matter what. I don't know. George and I have different opinions about the Final Fantasy games, by the way, right? Because I feel like 8 is the number one offender for this.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of 8, and I recall you really dislike 9.
I love 9.
Oh, maybe maybe I'm
9 is my 9 is my favorite modern Final Fantasy game.
Yeah, the idea that there was a point at which some people sat around a table and said, "You know, let's just get rid of the game altogether and make this into a movie." And then they did it. And it was awful, right?
Don't call Metal Gear Solid 4 awful, Michael.
The cabal of
Well, who knows what will happen with that. But, you know, I mean, they made a Final Fantasy movie.
Right.
And I think the only way to understand that getting made was that they began to believe their own headlines, you know, their own kind of legend that,
right,
oh, these are great storytelling games. And so really what we were saying when we called them storytelling games is they tended to want to tell more of a story than most games did. Mm-hmm. You know, that they were story driven to an extent, but still at the heart of them, you had to figure out, you know, how to get through this battle against this boss with your three other players you're controlling or not, mm-hmm, and move on to the next one.
Right.
Right.
And so,
So to some extent, you're suggesting then that we've just caught up. Like, there's so many good stories now, or at least better stories or longer stories, that we don't have to settle for that sort of poor storytelling wrapped over mechanics or bad design, basically.
Yeah, I think that it seemed almost accidental that the kind of RPGs that Final Fantasy games were became the storytelling games, you know. The genre seems almost insignificant to me that, you know, other more contemporary games that tell rich stories don't necessarily have to be RPGs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, but I think for a while we thought there was kind of a one-to-one correlation there, you know, so if you're going to do an RPG, you're going to tell this big epic story.
Right.
It's so interesting to me, though, that the way you're describing Xenoblade Chronicles still feels to me like a sort of classic JRPG story, right? Huge amount of characters. Like, is that type of storytelling still accessible, or is it just, do you feel like it's more accessible because they do a good job of tying it in with the world and the mechanics?
Yeah, I mean, that's where, you know, it's that funny rule, you know, that you tell, like, playwrights, don't do it this way, unless you do it really well.
Yeah, exactly.
And, it's smarter. I don't know how else to say it. It's just, it's smarter.
Yeah. To go back to your analogy of working on an old car, I could see, and I imagine, I think there's a sort of romanticized version of working on a really old, you know, Model T or something in your garage, right? That sort of serenity, the zen and the art of motorcycle maintenance, if you will. But for the most part, people don't know how to work on cars, and you need manuals, and you need education to even know how to change your oil,
right?
You know?
Right.
So I feel like when you've got an RPG that is not only loaded with characters, but is loaded with a complex system and a really expansive world, right? I mean, I don't know how accessible these sorts of larger systems are. And maybe that's just the way that it has to be.
Yeah, I wonder about that too. How much of the love that I feel for Xenoblade Chronicles is because I'm such a long-time JRPGer and I see what this game has done to that formula to revise it in ways that I like, you know.
You were a mechanic, if you will.
Yeah, probably. And there's probably nothing wrong with that. That there's, it's probably good that, you know, there's kind of the driver's car, you know.
Right.
That you're not going to sell as many of them. They tend to be, you know, a lot more moving parts, if you will. mm-hmm. And kind of beg for the kind of engineer's mind to appreciate them.
Wasn't one of the earlier classes you taught about RPGs, like for your students?
Yeah, I did a seminar on RPGs.
Because it's like the to keep using your car analogy, it would be like, I learned how to drive on an automatic transmission, and then I later learned how to drive on a manual transmission, right? And it's like, it's a huge shock to your system when you first try to do that.
Yeah, this is where I think we have a real separation in the marketplace between, like, you know, when you and I talk, and I'll do a podcast, you'll do a podcast, somebody will come along and write a blog post. We're all talking to each other.
Right.
My students, by and large, thought that RPGs got better and better the more cinematic they became.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, there are a core group of sort of more hardcore ones that kind of like all the mechanical stuff, but... You know, Mass Effect represents something to them that it's a huge step forward. And when you add to that, then, you know, the open world versions of RPGs, Fallout 3 came out during the time we were doing that course. You know, it was just, they see what you can do technically, and it's also very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And that really does, I mean, let's be honest, it has a pretty persuasive effect on them.
Sure.
Yeah.
And you know what? I got to say, I'll totally contradict myself here, but I am playing these games on the Dolphin emulator on my PC,
right?
Because they look spectacular, and I can't stand to look at them through my Wii on my monitor anymore. So there you go. I'm just a hypocrite.
Well, I feel like, you know, Scott mentioned earlier in the podcast, you said that it's almost hard to know why people liked RPGs in the first place, right? Thinking back, I played a lot of RPGs as a kid. And now when I'm trying to struggle through a modern-day JRPG, or even thinking about purchasing one, I struggle with the idea of, why would I play this? What am I going to get out of it, right? And I think part of being familiar with the genre, or really any sort of genre conventions, is making it easier for you to know why you liked something, right? You can go into a game and say, okay, this is why I'm playing it, this is why I enjoy it. So maybe, Michael, for your students who preferred games that were more cinematic, to them what they thought was important was... storytelling and artful storytelling, and maybe there's artful storytelling in different ways, but if you're not capable of fishing that out and digging through it to find that piece that you enjoy, you might just swear off the whole affair.
Exactly. Yeah, I think you're exactly right. And you know, if they play these games and enjoy them and see what happens to them, they become experts at that. So now, you know, I've got guys having arguments about, you know, why Mass Effect 3 was obviously a step backwards in the trilogy. And wasn't as good as the first. You know, they're having the same conversations we had about Final Fantasy 7, 8, 9. Really.
Yeah. Because, you know, when in terms of systems of JRPGs, when I think about how people enjoy competitive multiplayer games, right? These are systems in which if you're not very versed in a game, you might still get something out of that, right? And that joy that you have from it at a very low level might evolve as you play, right? But when you first enter a JRPG, that type of joy that you might get from it doesn't necessarily change over the course of the entire game, right? You've got to have such a... And I guess really what I'm saying is it's just very difficult to design a system that is both welcoming and sort of grows with you.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's also the way you frame it, too. I mean, like, I play Chrono Trigger, like, once every year, once every 2 years or something. And mm-hmm. the allure to that is playing a game where, you know, it's all about decisions. Like, when you're going to use an item, when you're going to jump to the next land, you know, fight, magic, run, whatever. It's like, they're all there. They're all out in front of you. And the challenge is not to decipher them, but the challenge is to, like, order them. You know, it's a... You know, it's like kind of creating a garden or something like that. You know, you have all of these components, you know, and all of those things are there at the beginning, but you only get to see them all once you progress to a certain point in the game. Like the skills never really change. It's the tools that change as you continue to play the game, you know?
Yeah.
I'm interested in that garden analogy. So do you feel like you... in a certain way are tending your garden over time, that it's something that you're taking care of?
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny that you mentioned that too, because my most recent playthrough of Chrono Trigger, I went out of my way to use characters that I generally don't use that often. And, you know, it'd be like a person who plants the same types of flowers every single year and all of a sudden decides to switch it up. So it's like there's certain things that I'm learning, you know, like, oh, Robo is good at this type of thing. I never really used those double techs before. This, you know, the skills to learn those things are essentially the same, but what I get out of it is different, you know, because I'm arranging things in a different way. And it's not necessarily the skill of arranging it, but it's like noticing how those things interact with each other.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's the nice thing is that it's not, you know, it's not arcane and it's not, as antisocial as it sounds, has nothing to do with anyone else.
Yeah.
You know, it is like as close as you can get to like the natural laws of the world, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I like systems that change, though.
No, I mean, and it's good, but I think that, like, in our modern gaming context, I think that is one of the things that JRPGs continue to do well, whereas many other high-profile games are trying to model chaos. And, you know, JRPGs are something that are trying to give you all of these things and then just asking you to model what you will with the systems, you know, rather than trying to find out, like, the different aspects themselves.
So, using both the car analogy and the garden analogy...
The garden car analogy.
The garden car. Yeah, well, there's, you know, you could be a farmer on a bus or something. How much does customization matter to you, right? Because, Michael, in your article, you say, you know, it's not about the car, working on the car per se, but it's about making it the motor per the way you want. If you could be navigating these same systems, or, you know, even in the case of Xenoblade Chronicles, right, I imagine there are ways to customize your character in ways that don't necessarily relate to relationships. Maybe what weapons you choose or upgrading your armor, right? It feels like JRPGs and even Western RPGs to some extent are meant to be just a collection of so many choices, endless choices, right? In what ways are we allowed to constrain those choices, and how does that affect how you approach or understand an RPG?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, you could broaden that question out to, you know, beyond RPGs, just, you know, how much does choice drive you and how much controlling the outcomes, you know, is what is in it for you.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that's a wimpy answer, but I just think it's sort of a case by case thing. It just depends on what the game is giving me. If it's not giving me that, what I get instead.
It seems to me like one of the things that separate Western RPGs from JRPGs, or at least the way that we are commonly referred to them, is that in Western RPGs, you have the sort of effect over the story or effect over the moral choices that characters have in a way that irreparably changes how that story arc takes place. And when we look at JRPGs, as we were saying earlier, certainly the more cliche ones, they're basically one predetermined narrative arc, right? But when we're talking about complex systems, of which I think both of them are, there are a lot of different ways that we customize ourselves or customize our characters in those systems. Some of them that matter narratively, some ways that don't matter narratively. And it feels like, depending on what you're playing an RPG for, one can be more important than the other.
Right, right, yeah. Well, you make me think of the other game I mentioned earlier that I'm playing, Sleeping Dogs, which is not an RPG per se, but it does have RPG elements, and you do dress up your character and things open up, unlock, you can put them on your character. I know I am wearing the same pair of jeans and t-shirt that I had at the beginning of the game.
Has no one commented on that?
I did something where I wound up losing my pants. Maybe this is real life. No, it was a game.
As you do.
It was in that karaoke mission.
That was last Friday night. Somebody did comment like, hey, get dressed or something. I can't remember in the world of the game. But it doesn't mean a damn thing what you're wearing in that game. And actually, they give you little extras. You know, you get a cool car if you get this. I don't care. I drive the same car I've been driving in the game, and it gets me where I want to go, and I can even win races. And so that's not what the game is about for me. I love this game. I think it's great. I'm really having a blast with it, but it's so not about that stuff. And it's almost like they just need to make sure they give the people who are into that kind of thing, those little fun toys to play with, but you don't have to play with them.
right.
Your Wei Shen, by the way, sounds like a curmudgeonly old man.
That's right. He drives the same car he drove 50 years ago.
Kids these days in their Lamborghinis.
Well, you know, by the end of that game, he does become kind of a curmudgeonly old man in a certain way, but anyway.
Great, Michael. Now you're making me want to play this game that I know is a huge open world game.
It is. Yeah, I've gotten sucked into it pretty, yeah. But what I like there is that the game design has enough flexibility to it that there's no rule that says, okay, so if you're going to have a clothing system that, you know, with better, medium, worse clothes, whatever, there has to be a way of leveling those up. Da, 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 that, you know, it's a case-by-case thing, and it's what you want to offer players to do. But I do think you're right that if... In JRPGs, typically you have to activate that stuff. It can't just be window dressing. Mm-hmm. I think it's fun to give a player that option in Sleeping Dogs, but in a JRPG, if you offer me a different sword and the sword isn't any better than the other sword, then you've sort of lost an opportunity for me to make a decision. And since JRPGs are so driven by this kind of spreadsheet mentality that I don't say that in a derogatory way, that you can really compare this against this and know that if I choose this in this situation, but then switch out before I go into this situation, that will help me. And it helps me because I'm smart enough to remember to make that change, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or, you know, I can actually morph things. You talk about persona, you know, you can actually then start to like fuse things, and then
right. You
feel like you're not only using the resources, but you're combining them in creative ways.
Oh gosh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so time consuming.
Oh my God. Yeah. But you know, it's just more kind of grist for the mill for the player that says, I love it when you give me stuff that actually affects my gameplay and gives me a chance to optimize.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I do think that is central to the JRPG experience, and certainly Xenoblade doesn't cast that away. And one thing I should say, just real quick, is that it does have a great battle system. If you could say, if there's one thing about the game that I would say would surprise people as a JRPG, it's how awesomely cool the battle system is, because it's active, it's very strategic, it's all about positioning yourself, thinking ahead, stopping things that are going to happen before they happen, because you get this little power to sort of reverse time, but sort of see what's going to happen ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Just little cool things they've done with battles that make it another world beyond the kind of turn-based stuff you're used to with JRPGs.
That was exactly what I was going to ask in terms of the future, like looking ahead. You know, what do you like to see rolled into the modern JRPG? And also, like, what do you like seeing rolled into traditionally non-JRPG style games that, you know, have been traditionally JRPG mainstays?
I guess I think that probably the obvious convergence is more and more open world structure. It's just the inevitable next step. If you're going to give me this really compelling world and all this really cool stuff to do and a story that's told inside it, there are these times when you bump into the walls there, and they really do sort of feel like artificial walls. And I just sort of do wish I could kind of go wandering off over there and do something, you know, else.
Right.
And it's funny, when you play several games at once, you get into a mentality and you can kind of, it's hard to switch gears, so you go from one to the next and suddenly you notice the stuff you can't do in this game that you can do
right.
in the other game.
Right.
So I think that's probably the biggest thing that, and of course that's a whale of a design problem, right? I mean, it's a huge algorithmic nightmare.
Right, right. It's interesting to hear about like the fast-paced thing, because I feel like that was a huge shift for me anyway. That was kind of when I started losing track of what was going on with the genre, like maybe around the, you know, the time Final Fantasy 12 or something was coming out, you know. And now I'm trying to slowly get back into it. And I remember being really impressed by Final Fantasy 13, like how they were able to take some aspects that were very familiar from like the turn-based, like what do you want to do? Fight magic item. And then put it together with something that looked a lot like, you know, a Western MMO or something. And hearing about Xenoblade and how that, you know, how it handles that thing, it seems like there's actually like a fairly strong push to, you know, modernize that older system, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think stripping out some of that kind of classic JRPG drippy sentimentality is a huge part of it, too.
Yeah.
This is not a sentimental game at all. I mean, there's little bits and pieces of characters who've been harmed in personal ways, but the game does not go where JRPGs typically go with that stuff. I think maybe that's one reason why you played Chrono Trigger every year.
Right. Yeah,
that's also not a drippy sentimental JRPG.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the way you're describing Xenoblade Chronicles, of course, makes me want to play it, but that lack of sentimentality or the personal narrative, I think, is something that is one of the reasons I liked the JRPGs I played in the first place at all, right? Chrono Trigger, some of my favorite moments from Chrono Trigger are about one individual that, you know, the other characters don't even see. There's these little small moments where it feels like this isn't a story about grand adventures between machine and Mother Earth in the form of a hawk or something like that. Yeah. This is a story about individuals,
like a family
and how they,
or something.
Yeah, how they relate to each other in that really intimate way. And I think whenever we have a world that's so big, it's really easy to lose a sense of intimacy. I mean, it sounds like Xenoblade Chronicles manages to keep that, even though it has a huge character roster. Mm. But I feel like when I'm thinking about what are the things that JRPGs or any RPG really has to do to keep me interested in the future, it has to have that level of intimacy that you don't always get in really large tales of awe and wonder.
Yeah, exactly.
So before we wrap up, you know, we always ask people who come on the podcast, you know, we've been talking about it a lot over the course of the show, but has there been any other games that have been catching your eye aside from the big Xenoblade Chronicles and Sleeping Dogs?
You know, you asked me earlier where the genre might go next or how can you think about an RPG differently. I haven't played it for a while, but I played probably about 35 hours or so of...
just a little bit.
Yeah. A little bit. Of the Secret World.
The MMO.
Yeah.
That seemed really interesting, actually. Like what they were trying to do with that, like on the meta layer and stuff.
It totally is. And I have this feeling, maybe I'll be dead wrong, but I have a feeling that after this game fails, and I don't want to say that it is going to fail, but that
it's failing as we speak.
It's going into a you know, brutally harsh MMO environment right now. Like
exactly. But there are so many good ideas just either not executed well, or some of them are executed well, or just sort of buried in messy other stuff. Mm. I just have a feeling that we're going to look back on this game like in, you know, 5-10 years and say, you know, they were really trying something with that game that pointed the way towards, you know, where we might want to go.
Mm-hmm.
They just didn't pull it off. And the sad thing to me about that is that, you know, you get gamers together and they're always talking about how they get tired of this and that, they want this and that. But I find gamers, particularly serious gamers, to be actually a very conservative bunch. And when you really do throw something really genuinely new at them, I think their first inclination is to reject it.
Right. Gus Mastrapa wrote a really good article about this a while back, about how for a long time he didn't like olives, basically. And then he tried them again and realized he could really love and appreciate them, and then he likened it to Spelunky.
I think more often than not, it's a limit of what they can take,
right,
or what we can take.
Right. Yeah.
Right? I don't want to exclude myself from that bunch, because there are games that do things. Because, you know, your exclamation that The Secret World is something we'll look back on in 10 years' time, I think that's generally the case with MMOs right now anyway. I think Terra does a few things really interesting and a bunch of other things sort of not all that interesting. Yeah. But the things that it does do... that are interesting, I think, will have an effect on both MMOs and RPGs in the future. I think we could say the same thing for Guild Wars 2 or the Old Republic.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, I agree, and I see those games, though. Well, I haven't played, I don't know a lot about Guild Wars 2, but they pivot on things that we know and understand, and they maybe move them in a slightly different direction, or they iterate on this or that. And Secret World just kind of jumps off the cliff a few ways, you know. I mean, it goes crazy particularly with its ARG elements. That stuff that just you don't see. I mean, you just don't see that in typical RPGs. And the what you're asked to do in that game sometimes is just confounding. It's kind of, as you mentioned, sort of meta, but also inside game. But then you think the meta thing that you think is meta is actually all designed in, and it's all fake world. But right. You're on the web, and I don't know. It's
yeah. I saw a screenshot where there was like a web browser inside the game, but then yeah, another mm-hmm. fake computer terminal alongside of it, and well, yeah, like
yeah. Yeah, and you have to, you know, you have to go visit a website to find out what's going on, and. But it's also set in a contemporary setting. It's an espionage kind of thing. It's
right.
You know, some of the things aren't new per se, but they feel new in that kind of MMO space. And the sad thing about it is that I got the sense that the developers were just dying to try to respond to whatever the players wanted and give it to them. Mm-hmm. And they were really at the, you know, they kept doing these blog posts and they were really on the job and they wanted it to succeed, and they were ready to, yeah, and if players didn't like this, then they'll try something else, you know,
right?
And it just doesn't feel like it's going to have enough momentum to keep them going.
I mean, Funcom was working on that since what, like 2007?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all, I mean, that's the other thing probably about JRPGs as well. I mean, they take a really, really long time to make, and then also to localize. I mean, it was a huge struggle just to get Xenoblade over to the States.
Oh,
and
God.
Similar to The Last Story, actually. I feel like that game has been done for a long time as well.
Yeah.
So you're kind of reaping the rewards a few years late, and so you're really not necessarily playing it in the contemporary context that it was released in.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of an interesting way to experience those games, you know, especially those games that were started when, you know, everyone was gunning for WoW or who wanted right. to be the next Final Fantasy, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and it's a big old game. I mean, I would encourage people before it disappears, and I hope it doesn't, but if it does,
right,
you know, jump in and take a look at it. It's huge, and there's a lot to see.
Is it free to play?
Sadly, no. They've opened up a few weekends to give people a chance to take a look at it. I don't know if there's a new one coming up, but in the past couple months, right. They've had a few free weekends. But no, it's like $15 a month.
You know, I bet that will change, like most things, you know, like most games are going these days, you know?
Yeah.
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 Well, I actually heard that it was partially, well, I mean, not to get too
this
much.
This is now the
world.
Secret World podcast, everybody.
but the retail cost itself, like just buying the game is expensive.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Each step of the way, I've kind of been shaking my head thinking, oh, dude, that wasn't a good idea.
Right.
And even inside the game, you know, you're thinking, oh, boy, that's, you know, maybe they didn't play test it long enough or whatever.
Mm.
But, and the characters, you know, they do go on. I mean, there's a lot of speechifying in this game. Long, long, long-winded, philosophical sort of pondering.
Wow.
But
it's a lot of talking for a secret world.
It is indeed.
George.
keep it quiet.
Yeah.
Okay, well, on that note, maybe we should cut our losses, right? Michael, tell everyone where they can find you online, because there's a bunch of places. So plug what you want to plug. We'll gladly put that out there.
Well, you can find me on brainygamer.com, and that's the best place. I teach at Wabash College, and you can see what we're up to at wabash.edu.
You'd apply, maybe?
Certainly you can apply. Love to have you.
It was paging the Wabash Development Office right now. They're like, yes.
Yes.
Abbott's finally doing it.
We have, you know, there are several guys in my class that this is really cool that, you know, had read the site before, whatever, listened to the podcast. And so they kind of came ready to go, and which is awesome. Great. But then when they, like, point out how you contradicted yourself in class, I like, you know, you wrote that post back in June. Like, oh, yeah, I did, didn't I?
And you can't really ban them since they're sitting there in person.
Can't ban them. No, can't.
Well, you can grade them, so.
I can grade them, yeah, and I will. But yeah, those are where I mostly hang out, and we occasionally throw together a group to do some vintage gaming and run a place called the Vintage Game Club, which we're going to try to breathe some new life back into soon, I hope.
Oh, yeah. It's a good place. I'm actually using the past message boards of Killer7, because I've resolved to finally finish Killer7.
You're brave.
Yeah. God. And so, I started searching around for people, you know, just discussing it just so I can kind of wrap my head around it. And that was like, that's what came up. And, you know, yeah. It's like you and David Carlton and a bunch of other people, you know.
Cool.
Cool. So yeah, housekeeping for us, George, what do we do? We'll open up the floor to everyone, obviously, if you have any questions for us. We're always here, experiencepoints@gmail.com. That's our email address.
And experiencepoints.net is the website.
Cool. And then, again, Michael, thanks for coming on the show. Always a pleasure.
Yeah, we can't thank you enough.
Oh, you kidding me. You guys are the best. And I mean that literally. You are the best podcast devoted to games.
Take that, idle thumbs. Web,
so, I'm just saying.
You're right here, folks.
All right. Well, again, thanks again for coming on the show. Appreciate it. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Until the next time, take it easy.